This is a recording of Noreen J. from Exeter, California, taped at the first California Mid-State Regional Convention for NA in Fresno, California, on Friday, June 29, 1990. In observance with the 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all NA speakers.
At this point, I would like to now speaker Noreen J. from Exeter.
My name is Noreen, and I am an addict.
And,
shit, this is a big deal, you know, for me. They say there's no big deals in this fellowship, and, you know, this program is about obsessions, and it's about self-obsession, and I have been so self-obsessed the last several days. It's like I was sitting in my living room yesterday, and I've taken the day off and spent it with my kids because he's at the babysitter, so I can have a good time when I'm done here. You know, hopefully I'll have a good time when I'm here too. But and I was just laying back, trying to relax and trying to relax. And man, this was running. You know, I have done this pitch I don't know how many times. You know, and it's a real honor for me. It's a whole lot better being in this room. When I first got here, my friend pointed that other room out, and I got up on the stage and went, whoa. So this is a whole lot better, because I can just kind of pretend like this is a regular old Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I'm one of your members of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm going to share my story. And that makes it, you know, makes the butterflies go away a little bit. I'm real grateful to be clean today. You know, I love Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm real grateful to have been given this honor. You know, it's like I was in the bathroom a few minutes ago, and I've been asking God a whole lot to take the ego away. You know, one of the crazinesses of yesterday was about, well, what am I going to wear? You know, and I'm like trying on clothes and back and forth, and it's like it really hit me. You know, talk about ego. That's about ego. What does it matter what I wear? But I couldn't turn loose of that, you know. It's like part of me wanted to just sort of be in jeans and an NA t-shirt, and then part of me wanted to honor the honor that this is, you know. And so, but I did put the prom dress away. You know, I said, no, that's a little much, you know. You know, my disease acted itself out in a lot of different ways. You know, it's like my disease was real apparent in me way before I started using drugs. You know, I was a real lonely kid. I grew up an only child, and even from way back, I always felt like somehow other people kind of had this message. They kind of knew what to do. I always felt odd. I always felt different. It's almost like other people could talk to each other and have fun, and you know, even from way back, as a little kid going to birthday parties, I would get nervous and I would feel funny, and I would just go back and forth about what to wear and stuff like that. Like, I lived a lot with relatives, and I can remember my mom telling me, I lived with my aunt and uncle for a period of time, and I saw my mom on weekends. I remember my mom telling me, whatever you do, be good. And it was like, you know, I had no even idea, well, what was that? And so it's almost like walking on eggshells all the time, and I lived with this aunt and this uncle, and they were real perfectionists. It's like, I can remember years later, I went through night school and I got my BA, and I'd done it all in night school, working full time. And when I told this particular uncle, you know what, I finally did it, I finally got that degree, his only comment to me was, well, was it cum laude? In other words, did you get straight A's? And I didn't. I got close, but I didn't. And it's like, to him, that was nothing. Unless you were perfect, unless it was the very best, nothing in between mattered, you know. And it's like, so I grew up real, real early, learning how to please people, learning how not to make waves. And, you know, I lived in this house. It was in San Fernando Valley. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. And my bed was out in the garage with kind of the covered up furniture. And it was like they had this really nice house, and I had a cousin who was older than me. But at nighttime, you know, my bed was out in the garage. And, you know, a lot of things I'm going to tell you today are things that I've learned since then. You know, things about feelings, because at the time, I almost just fell over. At the time, I didn't know about feelings. You know, a lot of what I'm going to share with you are things that I've learned through working inventories, through doing a lot of writing, and through the fellowshipping in this program. Because for a lot of years, I didn't feel at all. You know, I used a lot of head games, even back then. You know, like I said, I was a really lonely kid. And when I was about, I guess, 8, my mom and I got a house by ourselves, and we moved out from my aunt. And I remember her telling me, you know, Mom doesn't have enough money to pay for a babysitter, but my big girl won't be afraid. And it's like, okay. And you know what? That little girl was very afraid. And I can remember I'd leave all the lights on, and I'd have a poker, and I'd have a knife. And like, well, you know, I was a little kid. What am I going to do with this stuff? You know, I have my protection. And I fantasized. You know, I watched TV a whole lot, and I read a whole lot, and I put myself in other worlds. And I was real capable of doing that. You know, my ability to deny the feelings that were going on goes way, way back for me. I learned that, and I learned that real well. And so what I would do is I would pretend to be Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and I was always the hero. And I'd fantasize, you know, having a bunch of friends. And I'd live in my head, and I did not feel what was going on around me, you know, and I never felt like I belonged. I never felt like I fit in. That was one of the really wonderful things about coming to this program. It's like I heard people saying out loud, putting words to the way I'd felt in my gut all of my life. You know, I heard people saying things that I'd felt, but I didn't know how to put words to it. I didn't know what it meant. And when I came to these rooms and heard people talking about always feeling less than and always feeling left out, and it was like, wow, I'm not the only one, you know. And that's, I think, one of the joys of this program for me. You know, I have got so much support in this room right now, you know, and it just gives me goosebumps. And the last few days, people have just been hugging me and saying, hey, you know, it's okay, and get out of your head. That's Noreen talking, get out of your head. But, you know, it's like I never felt okay. And so real early, I started using other things to feel good. You know, I felt okay about going to school, and when I'd make an A, I'd feel good for like maybe 5 minutes, and then that would be gone. And about 13, I started getting a boyfriend. And it was like, yeah, wow, that made me feel okay. That made me feel almost as good as some girls and better than other girls. And it didn't matter that he didn't treat me real good. It didn't matter even that he didn't spend a whole lot of time with me. It was a thing to make me feel other than I was. It was something to validate me, you know. And we're talking years ago. You know, I was a teenager in the 60s. And so, consequently, you have a boyfriend, you start screwing. They did not talk about birth control back then. It was something that, you know, we didn't even talk about sex back then, much less birth control. So, consequently, at 14 years old, I got pregnant. And, you know, that was in 1963. And it was, I can tell you the feelings about it today. Back then, it was like, hey, you know, I wasn't feeling. I was totally shut down. And we did a lot of different things to try to get rid of that child. You know, it's like there was a lot of times when he'd hit me in the stomach trying to get rid of that child. I ingested a lot of weird things. I, you know, put a lot of weird things up my body. And, you know, God intended on me to have that child. And, you know, it's real funny. When I talk to you about my denial, I didn't know how to cope with that. I didn't know how to cope with being pregnant. So I put it out of my head. I didn't think about it. And, you know, and to show you kind of the no-talk rule in my house, at one point my mom had said to me, Noreen, are you pregnant? I said, nope. And so she left it. She didn't bring it up anymore, and I didn't bring it up anymore. And I think she asked me twice. And that was back when, like, tent dresses were popular and real loose clothes and so, and I didn't eat at all. And I went to school, and nobody knew, you know, and nobody knew. And it was like the times when I'd think about it, I was scared to death, but I just didn't think about it. And I was able to put that out of my head to the point where, through the whole time, school let out for Christmas vacation on Wednesday. On Saturday, you know, when a woman gets ready to have a baby, she passes some blood. My denial was so strong. When that happened to me, I said, I knew it. I knew I'd start my period. I knew this wouldn't be real, you know. I can remember thinking that, you know. And then these pains started. And it was like, I still didn't talk about it. My mom came home from work. We're decorating the Christmas tree, and every so often I'm like, oh, and holding my middle. And finally I told her, you know, I don't feel real good, and I went and laid down. And the father of the baby called, and I said, I think I'm having this baby. And he said, oh, good, we can go out in a field somewhere and nobody will know. And I said, you know, I can't do that. It hurts too much. And so finally, at this point, I told my mom, and this was in Canoga Park, and we're on our way to the hospital, and she said, did you take something? You know, I didn't know what she meant. You know, I said, no, I couldn't even find an aspirin. And what she meant was, did I take something to get rid of the baby? Because I wasn't very big. And we got to the hospital, and they didn't want to let me in. Here I am. I just turned 15 the month before. No prenatal care. And they did not want this young girl in that hospital. And the doctor took one look at me, and it was like, we had no choice, you know. And I can't, you know what? I don't remember feeling a thing in there. I don't remember feeling a thing. I remember being in the delivery room and looking, and I could only see one leg, and I thought, oh, it's only got one leg. And that whole period of time for me is real blank, you know. It's like I went home, and we, of course, moved in with my mom, and they wouldn't let me go to school. And that was the one place where I would sometimes, you know, I'd feel good, like I said, for just a minute, and they wouldn't let me go to school. Kind of like, well, hey, you got pregnant, you had a baby, and they didn't want to expose the other kids to that, like it's catching. And so what they did was they installed this telephone line in my house, and that's how I was able to go to school. And I can remember one of the things that when I did my first fourth step that I felt real, one of the many things, but one of the things that I had to dump that I felt so horrible about was it was so important for me to go to school that when, and they'd get mad if they heard your baby, they'd, who's got their baby? You know, like, and most of us were young single girls at home. Some of them had moms with them, but a lot of us, you know, my mom had to work, and so I was there with that baby by myself. And I can remember one time putting that baby in her little infant seat in a room, and she started to cry, and I just stayed on the phone, you know, and I just stayed on the phone. And it was like after a couple of hours after me being on this school, my connection, I went and I got her, and I felt so bad, man. I just felt so bad. And I can remember that. You know, I can remember feeling like, oh, how horrible I was, and feeling really split, too, like it didn't dawn on me then that the reason school was so important to me, because that was the only thing I felt good about. Back in 1963, when you have a baby, not only did they not let you go to school, but it was like I had no friends. And I was never real good at making friends anyway. I was always afraid. I'd moved a whole bunch when I was young, and like that first day at school, who am I going to eat lunch with? And you know that still happens to me today. If I go to a workshop or something and one of my friends from work isn't there, it's like, oh, God, who am I going to eat lunch with? So some things get better, some things don't. But it was real hard for me to connect with people, you know. And when I'd make a friend, I'd usually stop there at one friend because it was so painful for me. And I was just real lonely, you know. And my mom said, you get married. His parents said, you get married. He was 17, so it's kind of like we shrugged our shoulders and got married. And it lasted a hot 11 months. So at 16 years old, I was divorced. I had a year-old baby, and I was living with my mom. And, you know, as I said, I lived in San Fernando Valley. And what we did for date night, if you will, was we go into Hollywood. That was the big thing. And there was also Van Nuys Boulevard, which every town's got it. You know, Visalia's Mooney Boulevard. I don't know where it is in Fresno, but every town's got their cruising place. And ours was Van Nuys Boulevard. And I was out every night. You know, what I know about today is that I was real lonely, and I was looking for somebody to care about me. At the time, it was just like I was driven. You know, I couldn't, at night, my mom would get home from work, and I'd be gone. And I didn't even say, this was before I was getting loaded. You know, I had started to use the drug alcohol, but I hadn't gotten into illegal chemicals yet. And it's like I was driven. And, you know, I'd have maybe a date, if you'd call it that, one night kind of thing, and I was real lost. In the mid-60s in Hollywood, there was a lot of pot around. You know, Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard, hippies started coming around. And, you know, I found my niche. It's like I started hanging around down there. I started smoking marijuana. Like, I was out down there every single night, and it was like, hey, I'd arrived. I loved this. You know, I had a welfare check coming in. I was hanging around this place where a lot of bike riders were. Here's this young girl that's got a little bit of money that can pay for beer and hamburgers. It was great. And what happened was I was just like barely 17. My grandpa had died. My mom went back to Kentucky to his funeral. I went to Hollywood and said, hey, my mom's gone. Boom, I had 30 bike riders at my house. And we proceeded to party. And she came home early. She came home like 2 days early. And there's people in her bed. Her furniture is broken. And there's I don't know how many empty beer cans and... She said, you know what, you can go, and if you think you're taking that baby with you, and she didn't even have to finish that sentence, but I was gone. And for about 7 years, I was out there real hard and heavy. And you know, it was real obvious that I was a dope fiend. I worked hard at being a dope fiend then, and every so often, like maybe once a year, once every 6 months, my guilt would get me, and I'd get somebody to drive me to my mother's in Riverside so I can go see my kid, and they were glad to see me, and it was real weird. I can remember one time visiting her and having a bunch of pills and sitting in the rec room dropping these pills on the floor, you know, and it's like, I think about that today, and it's like, and they didn't really get in my face, but neither did they ask me to stay, you know, and it's like, there was a lot of time in those years where I didn't have a place to live. You know, it's like I was talking with someone the other day, you know, and we talk about demoralization in this program. You know, we talk about reaching a bottom. And I was in that place for so many years before I even thought about recovery. You know, before I even knew that, hey, this is a bottom. This is not where you want to be. You know, it's kind of like I thought, this is what my life is about, and I don't deserve anything more. You know, I was running around with some pretty hard people. I'd run away at 17. These guys were always talking about just getting out of jail, and I can remember one time a guy saying, yeah, I just did a bullet. You know, and I was like, wow, what does that mean? You know, and he goes, I just did a year in jail. And I thought, yeah, all right, I want to say that. You know, my values were I wanted to be a convict. You know, I saw these guys all kind of live, hanging around together and sharing these memories of when we did 3 years up here and 2 years there. And one more time I wanted to be a part of, and one more time I was left out. So on my 18th birthday, I got my wish. I got arrested. And for drunken, disorderly, and disturbing the peace, you know, and I took me up to FBI, my first of many trips. That's the women's jail in Los Angeles. And I spent one day there, and when I got out, yeah, I just got out of SBI. You know, I started talking that talk, and thank goodness nobody said, how long were you there, and what are you there for? But, you know, that goes to show you where my values were, you know. Like I said, that was a bunch of many trips, and there was a lot of times I'd come to, and I'd be in jail, and I'd have to get the booking slip out and look and ask somebody, well, what do these numbers mean? Some of them I got to know real well. But, you know, and it's like that made no difference to me. That was part of my whole idea that, you know, I'm an addict and I just can't control this. And I took great pride in being able to use as much as the next guy. And you know what? When I got to this program and we talked about step one and we talked about step two, I was real able to do that because I know that my God was watching out for me for a lot of years before I even kicked in and cared at all. You know, there were things, there's a lot of times when I did things that were totally, totally insane, and I lived through it. You know, I was sharing with a friend of mine earlier coming up here about, you know, in the 60s there were a lot of pills, and I was a barbiturate addict. And I got to the point where there were several times when I seizured, and I can remember one time I woke up in the hospital and like my hand was like a claw and it wouldn't work. And there was flowers there and there was a card on the flowers and I couldn't read the card. And the doctor would come in and he'd hold up the pen and say, do you know what this is? And I'd shake my head and he'd say, well, what is it? And I took my other hand and I like wrote with it. So it was like I knew what it was, but there was a part of my brain that I'd shorted out. And it was so funny because that happened to me from withdrawal. That happened to me from a seizure behind drugs, And these guys, these medical people are wondering, you know, what's going on with her, and thinking I have a brain tumor. So they're doing all these procedures, and one of them, they shot some stuff up my spine and said, you know, if you move during this procedure, you're liable to be paralyzed. And I just did my best not to move. Obviously, I didn't. But, you know, the insanity of the disease and the deepness of my denial, here I am, they're testing me for brain disorders and doing these tests to me, and it didn't dawn on me, oh, you know, I just was withdrawing from drugs. It didn't dawn on me that that was why it happened, and it didn't dawn on me to tell them about it. And at one point, you know, that happened to me twice, and I can remember the second time I was in the hospital, one of the doctors telling me, you know, if you continue to live the way you're living, you won't live to be 30 years old. And funny thing happened, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. When I was, in fact, 35, I'll do it now or else I'll forget. When I was 35, I was on my kitchen floor with a person I'd been living with who had a gun, and he was real angry at me, and was talking to his brother in Pennsylvania, saying, you know, Bobby, I'm going to do something here that I might regret, and then I'll probably get off. And I'm like, sitting on the kitchen floor with this guy who's got a gun who's threatening my life. And the thing I thought about was that doctor. Gee, they're going to be right, you know? And I didn't think this was the way I'd die. But, you know, and it's like my disease has gotten me in a lot of situations like that. You know, I continued and I continued and I continued. And I know God was with me because I made it through there. You know, there was times that I was drinking and using drugs, and I can remember us leaving Hollywood, and then boom, we were in Santa Monica. Oh, well, did you drive? I don't know. Did you drive? Well, how did we get here? You know, somebody had to be driving that vehicle, you know, because I sure wasn't looking out for myself, and I lived to go through it. You know, part of what had happened to me to sort of stop that era was I got arrested finally one more time for sales. And I bailed out. The next day I woke up and I'm back in jail. I'm like, well, now, wait a minute. I thought I just bailed out. I opened the pink slip. What had happened was I got out, and, of course, as usual, I got one coming because I've been in jail. And I got so bad that I was in a car, and I put the car in forward and hit the car in front of me, put the car in reverse, hit the car in back of me, and passed out. So they got me for drunken auto. They didn't even get me for drunk driving because I wasn't awake. But through that period of time, through that period of time, I picked up 7 felonies over a period of 6 weeks, and I got a year in the county jail behind that. You know, that's all. A year, and I didn't make the penitentiary yet, and I was still, you know, I was wanting to do that, but I did get a year, and I would tell the women up there, you know what, when they'd be leaving to go to the penitentiary, I'll see you up there. And that was like, you know, what I wanted to be when I grew up. And it was just a game. I mean, we did our thing. I was on the freight and trash crew, and we did our thing to get drugs in there, and, you know, which is insanity. I mean, you're in locked up, and you're, you know, smoking dope in the bathroom and in the shower, and it's just crazy. But it's like, that's where my mind was. And after doing 10 months, it's like, of course, I'm in jail. I'm writing to my mother, you know, and she's coming to visit me and sending me money, and, okay, I'm going to do this thing when I get out. And I got out in May of probably 71. And I went to Riverside, and by now my daughter's maybe, I don't add real well, so she's 8 or 9. And I'm going to make myself this, I'm going to put this square peg in that round hole, and I'm going to make it fit. I'm going to, because, you know, not obviously any kind of a woman, because a woman loves her child and wants to raise her child, and so I'm obviously not a woman. And so I'm going to go make myself do this. And I got a job in a bar, had a red connection within a week, you know. To show you the extent of my disease, my first night on the job, the lady says, you can drink all you want, okay? And this was luckily a local little neighborhood bar in Norco, and my shift started at 6. At 10, I'm in the back room, and I cannot stand up. I mean, I'm sitting back there, and one of the local patrons is pouring the beer, and she comes in and kind of looks and comes over, and she says, well, Noreen, next tomorrow night, don't start drinking until midnight. You know, and it's like, so I did that. You know, it was a good little job for an addict, and I worked there, and it took me 3 months to pick up another case. And what that did was, I thought, I'm on my way now, you know, I'll see you guys up there. And What they did instead was they sentenced me to one of those treatment facilities, one of those therapeutic communities, and that was back in 1971. It was at Patton State Hospital, and they used attack therapy, and it was like what I did. I learned real good to tell them what they wanted to hear. It got my attention, though. You know, it's like they said things to me like, well, you know, yeah, you don't have a problem. What are you doing in that house? And I had to listen to that. You know, and I stayed in that program for a year and a half, and they taught you, don't do drugs, but it's okay to drink. And naturally, I met a guy in there, and he told me he loved me. So, of course, we're together. I mean, I didn't care about him, but, God, you mean somebody loves me, somebody wants me? And so, of course, I was with him. And we got out of that program. And what that program did was it made me employable. I stopped sticking needles in my arm, and I never again did downers. So in my mind, I wasn't an addict anymore. You know, hey, I'm employed. I've got a boyfriend. I've got a house. I don't put needles in my arm. And in my mind, I was off of drugs, and I was drinking alcoholically. I was drinking like a fish. And it wasn't long. You know, this guy had said, let's get married, and then he told me he was still smoking dope, so I left. And he told me he stopped, so I went back and made the plans to get married. And about 2 days before the wedding, he says, oh, and by the way, I never did stop smoking dope, you know. And there was a part of me that wanted to say, forget it. But, you know, I couldn't because I was going to be married. You know, and I had a job, and I had a house, and I was going to get married, and that meant I was going to be fixed, and I was going to be okay. I wasn't going to be an addict anymore. Because I had all those outside things. So I did what the usual thing. I started smoking with him. And it took probably, I added about a drug a year, you know. I mentioned to you earlier that I was going to night school, you know, and one of the things my family was real pushy, basically, about you go to college, you do this, you do that. So that was a goal that I always had. And I started, I got this job with the local county, and I was started going to school two nights a week. And at one point broke up with this husband and hooked up with another one. You know, I have a manalog almost as long as my drug-a-log. But, true story, unfortunately. but, you know, I started feeling like I was a citizen. You know, I went to work for mental health and they trained me and I went to school. And along about 1980, a job came open with drug abuse. And it was like, okay, well, yeah, I'm doing a few drugs, but hey, I've got this counseling experience, and besides, a lot of them were selling drugs and doing drugs, too, so it's like I took this job, and at the end of that first year, my school was over, I graduated, and it's like by then I'd hooked up with husband number three, and he had a brother who was from San Diego who had a real good speed connection, and I went hard and heavy for a number of years. You know, it's like when I no longer, you know, my going to school kept my disease in check for a while. You know, I would do my homework and then get loaded. You know, I would do my studying and then get loaded. And I did well. You know, it's like I was well trained to jump through those hoops, and I did well. But that doesn't last forever. And when it ended, I filled my spare time with what I know best, and that's getting loaded. And I still got this job as a counselor. And it got real, real bad. It got to the point where I'd stay up all night and I'd go into work. And being a counselor, you usually look at your clients, but I couldn't look them in the eye because they would have seen my eyes the way they were. So I'm trying to counsel without looking at people. And, you know, there'd be times when I'd go into my office and I'd shut the door and I had a mirror on the wall. And I didn't use that one. But I'd look at myself and I'd think, what are you doing? You know, the insanity of what I was doing, it would hit me. But it took a long time for me to do anything about it. You know, it's like I was using more and more. And, you know, the insanity, it's like I would get loaded before I went to work, and then I'd take some with me to go in the bathroom and use while you're at work in a drug clinic, you know. But it didn't hit me, and I started to get real flaky. I started to miss a lot of work, or I'd come in 2 hours late, and they'd be real angry for some reason. And I'd be self-righteous. Well, I'm here, you know. I'm gracing you with my presence. And I remember at one point one of the supervisors, and he's a guy I'd gotten loaded with, but, you know, he wasn't an addict. He called me in his office and he said, Noreen, there's two or three people that have told me you're coming to work loaded. And I'm going, who said that? Like, I'm going to go and get in their face because of what they said about me. And, you know, it was true. It was real true, but that was not, you know, my whole idea was, well, these guys are talking about my back, and they're going to get me in trouble. They are going to get me in trouble. And I came real close to losing that job. You know, they started doing a memo trail on me, and I started having to, like, bring in an excuse before I called in sick and stuff like that. And so I kind of reined my behavior in a little bit, and I said to myself, all right, I'm not staying up all night anymore before I go to work, so I'd live for the weekends, and I'm not going to do any drugs before I go to work. And the best I could do was I would do a little bit. You know, and I would just constantly, you know, that telling myself again and again, I did it today, I blew it, I'm not going to do it again tomorrow. You know, and it was like this insanity, like there was two people inside of me. And I can remember at that time in my life, I was really thinking, I had a gun, and I kept it underneath my mattress. It was a real cute little gun. It was a .38, but a woman's, and it was nice. And, you know, I liked it, you know, it was fun. And I'd pick up the mattress and look at that gun a lot, and I'd hold it. And I can remember one time, my husband at the time was in the shower, and I was really angry with him about something. I went and I, you know, kind of tried it on for size, you know, and thought, oh, boy, would that ever feel good? And then I thought, I better not do that. And I put it away, and a few days later, I shared this with him, you know. Like, I was thinking about shooting you the other day, and it's like he looked at me real weird, and I couldn't understand, well, what's the problem, you know? I didn't do it. And the same supervisor, I was, you know, he was somebody that I'd known for like 10 years, and I'd gone in, and I said, you know, Bob, I look at my gun and think about my gun a lot. And I had one of my jobs, I worked on the other side of, I had to go through this canyon a couple times a week. And when I was in the canyon, I'd be looking at the diesels and kind of playing with it. You know, now I wasn't suicidal, mind you, in my mind. But it's like I was really romancing death a lot. And I remember going into my supervisor's office and telling him, you know, I think about these diesels. And, you know, I wonder what would happen if my car smashed into one of them. And I'm also thinking about this gun a lot. And he's like, he was not an addict. And he's looking at me kind of shaking his head saying, Noreen, normal people don't do that. And I'm like, I had a lot of people around me that were concerned about me. But it's like, you know, I was off into this thing. And it didn't touch me. Narcotics Anonymous started in Riverside in 1983. A meeting started. And now, as I've been thinking about this story, and as I've been staying clean longer, I think it gets more real. The way I used to tell it was that our director told all the counselors to go to Narcotics Anonymous because our clients needed it. And then the more I get clear and the more I think about it, I remember, well, I went and another counselor went, so I don't think she told all of us to go, but she did tell me to go. You know, and they were really enabling me. I mean, but, you know, part of that is that I feel like God wants me to do the kind of work that I do. Because I've been in the counseling business for 18 years. I've been clean for 6, thank you. But a friend of mine likes to remind me, you know, talking about all that long experience, Noreen, how much of that was clean. But, you know, it's like they enabled me in a lot of ways, but it's like a lot of them told me the truth, and I didn't want to hear it. It used to make me real angry. And it's like I said, these Narcotics Anonymous meetings started in Riverside, and I'd go, and I'd be loaded, and by then I'd been popping to, yeah, I've been drinking some, and yeah, I guess I have a bit of a drinking problem, because this was a drug agency, you know, you couldn't hardly talk about that, but it was acceptable to talk about the other drugs. And so I'd go into these NA meetings and talk about, yep, I used to be dope fiend and I'm an alcoholic, and I'd be loaded. I mean, I would be out of it, and these guys would just kind of keep coming back, Noreen, you know? And the same thing, man, I would tell myself, I'm going to this meeting, you know, I better not get loaded. And the best I could do was to do a little bit. And in my mind, that was, well, I'm not going to get loaded. And I did that for a while. And you know what? It's like my world was crumbling around me. I was getting real, real crazy. I was getting to the point where I was hallucinating a lot. I was hearing voices. This house that I had had a bedroom in the back, and there was people living in there, and I could hear them. You know, I'd stand outside the doorway, and I could hear them talking, and so I'd open the doorway to try to catch them, and they'd be gone. So I'd shut the doorway again, and then I'd hear them some more, and I'd open the door, and I'm... Normal people don't do that stuff, you know? And I can remember being in the bathtub, and, like, hearing voices, hearing things coming out of the water, you know? And you know what I thought? I'll tell you, my denial works real well. I said, I knew I worked with crazy people too long. I've got schizophrenia, you know? This is because I did. I worked in mental health for 7 months, and I caught schizophrenia from those guys. And this is an educated woman. This is a woman that's supposed to be a drug counselor, right? This is a sick addict is what this is. And my denial was still working. And it's like part of what happened was things were crumbling. You know, I was really, really losing it. And they were following, you know, like following me at work. You know, I knew this one guy that I'd see on the street. I knew he was a narc, you know. And a few years after I got clean, I saw him. I said, you know that guy? He's a narc. And this bird looked at me and said, Maureen, that guy's a wino, you know. But I was sure. I was sure, you know. And, you know, it was like my mom was still alive at that point, and she was living around the corner from me. And it was like she'd come over and it's, you know, clean the top tabletops and put the stuff away, and I wouldn't see her very often. She lived real close to me, and I didn't see her very often. I didn't call her. Days were about, if dinner was at 3, I'd get there at 2:45, and I'd eat, and then I'd be gone. Unless I do have a cousin that uses also a couple holidays where I got there, we went over to his house, we missed dinner totally. So it was not... it was not your, you know, happy family. And, you know, the joy this program caused is like I was able to become a good daughter, you know. I was able to start repairing those broken relationships, you know. My husband at the time had gone down to San Diego and was coming back with 17 ounces. And I'd been playing with the program. You know, I'd been trying to, I'd stopped drinking. And I still did drugs, but I stopped drinking. So I'd be partying all night and somebody'd offer me a beer and I'd, no, I can't, I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink. And it's like, sure, okay. But you know, that was the best I could do. And it's like I knew that I was crumbling and I started with that. And I started, like I said, going to some meetings. And when I knew he was coming back to town with those 17 ounces, I left that night. Because I had gone through a period just that last month. You know, my heart would just be going and going and going. And I'd had these things going on in my stomach. And it's like I would feel like, you know, I'm going to die, man. I'm just going to die. And I'd be doubled over. And my heart would be pounding. And I think, I'm going to have a heart attack. And I'd do more. And I'd think, I'm going to have a heart attack. And I'd do more. So I knew if I was in that house with that amount of drugs that there's no way. You know, and it's like I left that night and I went to a motel room. And it's like, and I was hungover. I was loaded. But I'd been around coming to these rooms enough where I heard people talking. You know, I heard people say kind of the things that they'd done. And I can remember I was pacing back and forth, and I hurt so bad, and my gut hurt so bad. And I remember saying, you know what, God, please help me. Please help me. And my stomach lightened up a little bit, you know? And it's like I had some faith, you know? It's like he showed that, yeah, he's there in that moment. Even though I was loaded, it's like, you know, he touched me in that moment. And I never went back to that house. You know, I did go back, but after this person was gone. And I got involved in Narcotics Anonymous real heavy. And I'd like to tell you that, yeah, I never used again, and it was wonderful. But, you know, part of what happened for me is that I came in here, and people talked about working your own program. So Noreen worked sort of a marijuana maintenance program. And I was living with some people. She was a Christian, and I'd go to meetings, and then I'd come home, and I'd smoke some reefer with him. And she'd look at me and go, oh, Noreen, aren't you supposed to be being clean? I'm going, yeah, I'm working my program. This is my program. And it's like, you know, this is one more of God's messengers. You know, she was telling me the truth. She was telling me the way that it should be. And I didn't listen to her. You know, it's like, what happened is they elected me GSR of a meeting. And I was supposed to have, I was supposed to have 90 days. And so I went to my first area service committee meeting, and this was in San Bernardino, Riverside, Pomona area in 1984, and there was 8 meetings, and those 8 meetings now comprise maybe 6, 8, 10 different areas, hundreds and hundreds of meetings, which is just, you know, that's hot, man, that's hot, because we do grow and we do recover, and so I went to this area meeting, and I remember there was this real buff-looking guy, and he was really nice, and he had 5 years, and I thought, hey, you know, there's enough to stay clean for here, and hey, whatever works, you know, whatever works, and they elected me secretary of the area, and it was like, whoa, boy, now I really have a position, and I had 5 days, and I was supposed to have 90 days. And so I didn't tell anybody because I had a position now. You know, I was important. You know, that first little bit of time, that first long bit of time of being new, I don't know about you, but for me, it's like going and sitting in the meetings was okay because you could, like, stare at who was talking and act like you were listening, and they didn't know your head was, they did know, but I thought they didn't know. And you could kind of act like, yeah, I know what's going on. But then we had coffee breaks down where I got clean, Southern California. I hated the coffee breaks, man. It was like, because I don't smoke, and they'd be talking to each other. And so I'd go and I'd stand at the literature and sort of straighten the literature table, and then I'd go in the bathroom and stay in there for a while. God, it was awful. You know, my insides were just turning and jumping, and I'm sure the fact that I really wasn't being honest and being clean had nothing to do with that. But, you know, I'm say that kind of kidding, but bottom line is that when we're new, it's tough, you know. It was tough for me, and, I felt so uncomfortable. So getting into service gave me something to talk about. You know, it's like I'd see somebody, yeah, how about that area service committee meeting, huh? And did you get your minutes? And hey, and I volunteered for every single committee there was. If there was a committee meeting, I was there. And me and there was probably about 8 of us that I'd go to a meeting and these same people would be there. And I'd, you know, drive across town and go to another meeting and these same people would be there. And you know, the majority of those people are still clean today. You know, and everywhere I'd go, they'd go, you know, and we'd drive a half an hour to go to a meeting. And sometimes I think when we have a lot of meetings at our disposal, I think sometimes we get lazy. I get lazy. Well, I don't want to drive that far and da-da-da. And it's like, you know, it did me a lot of good to do that. And fellowshipping in the cars. And when I finally got to the point, my sponsor asked me to write my first three steps. And my sponsor, I picked this lady out, okay, and she was vice chair of our area, and she was dynamite, and I decided I wanted her to be my sponsor, and it took me another 90 days to ask her, because I was just, oh, no, she'll say no, or, you know, my head told me, she'll say, you work with you, ooh, you know, so that's my self-esteem, thank you, and finally, I was in an area meeting, and she was sitting next to me, and I had a cup of coffee, and she had a brand new purse and a brand new briefcase, and I spilled my coffee all over it, and it's like, I better ask her now, or she's never going to, you know, I had a tank top on and a shirt over, and I took my shirt off, and I'm drying her purse and drying her briefcase, and I'm like, oh, man, but this woman was real, real good for me. Real good for me. And it's like when I did my first three steps, she had me write out my first three steps. And when she said that to me, when she gave me that direction, I want you to write out your first three steps. I said, well, I've already done that. I want you to write out your first three steps. Well, I told you, I've already done that. I want you. Okay. You want me to do it for you. All right. And I procrastinated on it. But, you know, I did it. When I went over to her house to share those. And before I did, I said, I have something I have to tell you. First of all, I've been dating a guy, and because that was like a no relationships. And first of all, I've been dating a guy. And second of all, I really don't have 9 months. I only have 6 months. And I expected her to say, well, get out of my house, then, you sleaze. And she said, okay. And, gee, all right. And I said, well, what do I do about it? And she had given me direction that when you get up to take your 9-month chip at those meetings, just take a 6-month chip. But, you know, I found it, for me, I found it necessary to go to every meeting that I'd collected a chip in and share about it, because I felt real lousy. And I, again, you know, beat me up, kick me. You know, it's like, yeah, let me go to all these meetings and someone will throw me out the way I expect. But funny thing, that didn't happen. You know, people came up and they hugged me and they said, thank God you didn't have to go out behind that, Noreen, because a lot of people do. And, you know, sometimes I get a little jealous of people that come in and they do it honestly all the way through. Like, you know, a friend of mine and I were sharing about those first 30 days, and then I have to stop and think about, well, my first 30 days were really under the guise of being my 4 months. But, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Bottom line is that this program has worked for me, and I've been clean today, you know, and I've been clean a good amount of today's, and I'm real grateful for that. You know, like, I immersed myself in this program. You know, I went to meetings 6 days a week because I worked late on one night. I ate, slept, and drank Narcotics Anonymous. You know, for the first 9 months, I did not read anything other than program literature. Or I'd write, because I was not sleeping. You know, I came in here pretty whooped. And, you know, God allowed me to beat my head against that wall a whole bunch of times before I became willing and before I decided, yeah, you know what, I want what you guys have. I don't know what it is. I mean, I was real confused, but I want what you guys have. And so I got real involved, and I went to a bunch of meetings and did a lot of reading and did a lot of writing. And, you know, where I got clean was in Riverside in the Inland Empire area. And at 2 years clean, 4 days before my two-year birthday, I met a man, and in my usual way, after the first date, boom, you know, we were together every single night. And and it's funny, because I'd done a relationship inventory at 16 months, because I'd been through the same relationship time after time, different names, same relationship, and repeated the same mistakes over and over. So I'd done this relationship inventory to change things. And I can remember her giving me specific direction. Make sure they have a car, because I was real good at hooking up with people that either were fresh from their mothers or fresh from jail or fresh from, you know, if they were unemployed or unemployable, yeah, that's the kind I liked. And so she gave me specific direction. You know, make sure they have a car that's running. It doesn't need to be new, but just running. Make sure they have their own house. You are not to let them spend the night at your house, not to let them leave anything there. And so what I did was I didn't do that. I went to his place and manipulated it a lot. You know, it's like lying by omission. Well, I didn't really lie to you, but yeah, I didn't tell you the truth, the whole truth either. And I thought I'd had it made. You know, it's like I got pregnant, and after about 7 weeks, I had a miscarriage. And it's like, you know, one of the theme of this convention is unity. And you know what? There were so many women that were there for me. You know, so many women. And it's like, I talked to my sponsor when I was in the emergency room, and she was there for me. And I went back home, and women that had miscarriages called me, you know, and that was unsolicited. They called me just to say, hey, I know how you're feeling. This is probably how you're going to feel tomorrow, and you can call me anytime, you know. And it's like people went out of their way to be there for me. And part of what had happened just a few months after that, too, was that my mom had a real bad heart attack. And I celebrated my first birthday on a Monday. That following Wednesday, she'd had a stroke. And so I missed a lot of my cakes that week. But it was real lightweight, you know, it was like no bad effects and so on and so forth. And for those year or two after that, I was able to be a real good daughter. You know, I was able to go over to her house and able to, when she was sick, go get her and take her to the doctor. You know, I had done that amends step with her, and it was like she didn't want to hear it. All she cared about was that I was clean and that I was living a good life and that I was available and participating in her life. And in fact, I don't think she really would admit that, yeah, I was an addict, am an addict. But it's kind of like that first stroke brought me to, you know, got my attention. So that I'd gotten that call, and she was in intensive care. And I called one person and said, I've got to go to the Garden Grove Hospital. My mom's in ICU. Boom. And, you know, within 3 hours, addicts started walking in that emergency room, man. You know, people that, there was a woman who just lost her brother to AIDS. There was a woman whose mom had died the year before that. And there was a woman whose father had died like a year before that. And these people just came, and they had, you know, maybe one of them had met my mom, but they didn't know my mom. But you know what? They knew me, and they loved me, and they were there just to help me walk through that. And the other miracle of this program was that when she'd had surgery, the doctor had come out and said, you know, the last time you'll be able to see your mom alive is now, and she's not conscious, but for you to come and see her, this will be the last chance. And my husband at the time had said, you know, if there's anything you need to say to her, Noreen, this will be your last chance. And you know what? My house was clean with her. It's like there was none of that. I didn't have any unfinished business with her, and I was able to just go and say goodbye. And say goodbye with a clean heart, you know, and a clean soul. Not just free of drugs, but free from that guilt and free from all of that stuff that I had done to her, because I had taken care of that. Narcotics Anonymous had allowed me to take care of that. And you know what a freedom that is? And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm not telling you that it wasn't painful. I mean, I got so tired of going to meetings and crying and saying, oh, yeah, I'm Noreen, and I'm in a lot of pain, and it hurts, and I miss her. But you know what? You guys taught me to do that here. You taught me to speak from the heart, you know? And part of what had happened, too, is that I was pregnant at the time again, and I was able to tell her that before she died, that, you know, I'm going to have a baby. And, you know, in either 1968 or 1969, and I'm not sure which, because that was in those real years, I was pregnant with twins. And I was also strung out on barbiturates. And at 8.5 months, I had those babies, and one was stillborn, and one died after a few hours because of my disease. Okay? And I always felt like I'd never have another baby. You know, that God was going to punish me for, one, abandoning my first child, and for, two, for not taking care of myself and not taking care of those babies. And you know what? God doesn't punish me. I punish me. You know, my God loves me, and my God forgives me, and I'm the one that does all that stuff. And it's like he blessed me with a little boy, you know, and he's like 2 years and 9 months now, and he's a real blessing, you know. And I ended up getting married and then getting pregnant for once. You know, that was new. And I thought I'd had it made, you know, Mr. and Mrs. N.A. And, yeah. And I was real involved in institutional work. I was going into CRC down south once a week. And those women gave me so much. It's like those women walked me through my miscarriage. Those women walked me through my mother's death, and I'm there supposed to be carrying the message to them, you know, and I would leave there with so much love, and it was wonderful, and I miss that. I miss those women, but, you know, we've got women in Tulare County that we're seeing today. But what happened was that the baby was born and came up to King's Tulare to check it out. and went to somebody's house, and their kid was in 4-H, and they had a walnut farm, and it was like, wow, you can see them, you can see across the street. And, you know, which in Southern California, that's just amazing to see across the street. But at any rate, so it was all about resign my job, move up here, and in a period of 2 months, boom, I was up here. And that was, I went through a whole lot of changes behind that, you know, because it's like down south, I'd go in a room, everybody, hey, Noreen, and, you know, they'd always call on me, and I was real important. They made me feel real important. And then I got up here, and it's like, well, so who are you? You've got how much time? Yeah? Prove it. They didn't say that, but, and, some of them said it. Anyway. And where I grew up in Narcotics Anonymous, people were real, real into service, into the traditions, and into Narcotics Anonymous. And I'd go to meetings, and they'd be talking about out of another book and quoting stuff from another program. And it was like, I'd go home, and I'd just sob and say, what am I doing? You know, I'd pray, and I'd write, and it's like, what am I doing here? God, what's happening? Why am I here? And I looked at the differences. I compared. You don't do it the way we do it. They do it this way, you know. And it's like, and I was full of, I'm over here and you're over there. And for a while, I decided, well, I'll just read my book every night and pray and write, and that'll be enough. And you know what? I need these meetings for God to work through you. I need these meetings for God to speak to me through you. And just staying at home and reading my book and writing and praying just wasn't enough. So I started going, making myself go to the meetings, even though they didn't do it right, you know. I figured, you know what, I know I need meetings, and so I'd better go and be grateful for what I can here, and maybe set an example, I don't know. And it's like I'd gone to one meeting on a Sunday night, and they were talking about taking one representative for all the local meetings and sending them to the area, and it was like, you know, that wasn't the way we did it. And then I got dumped on. You know, people just, oh, man, well, who the hell are these people, Claire, that you've never seen before? And it's like, you know, and I wanted to keep my mouth shut, you know, about the service structure, but it's like I couldn't, and I caught some flack behind it. But you know what? We're an area today. You know, some people got together and decided, hey, if you don't want to drive so far to Fresno, we're so lazy, I'm so lazy, let's make our own area, you know, and we are an area today. And I'm a part of that because service is real, real important to me, you know. Yeah. And it's like, it seemed like, it, you know, it's like happily ever after. And part of what had happened was the person that I was living with had some workman comp things going on, and had had three surgeries. And this part's real hard for me. You know, I've prayed real hard about this because it's about what happened to me, not about what somebody else did, you know, because we are addicts, and addicts relapse. And I can welcome newcomers back into the room, but it's real a different story when it's in your house. It was a different story for me when it was in my house. And a lot of what I did for a period of time there was denial one more time. You know, it's like there was a lot of medication in my house. Sometimes I'd get up and it felt like dope fiend days one more time. You know, it felt like the old speed freak days where people had been up all night and I'm getting up and it's like, well, whoo. And you know what I did about that? I stuffed it, and I didn't talk about it, because some of that was protectiveness, some of that was shame, and some of that was, you know, this is my fourth marriage, you guys. If I admit to myself that there's active addiction in my house, and I believe in living clean, I have to do the next indicated thing and take care of it, and I couldn't bring myself to do that, so I stuffed it, and I didn't talk about it, and one more time, you know, rose-colored glasses and living in that daydream, and I'd go to meetings, and I've been around Narcotics Anonymous enough to be able to talk the book and to be able to talk about, you know, what you should do and the principles and blah, 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 but I was dying, You know, I was not telling you what was happening in here, what was happening in my heart, and what was happening in my life. And thank God there was some people around. I remember going to a picnic, and a girlfriend of mine knew what was going on, and she said, "How are you, Noreen?" I said, "Well, you know, it's okay." And she says, "How are you? Would you stop giving me that?" And I started to cry. And said, "Thank you. At least you're being real, you know." And she wasn't doing that to be mean. She was doing that to save my life. And I started going to some meetings where I felt safe and talking about what's going on. There was a real special woman that I worked with, and she was in the program, and she was the first one that I talked about the drugs in my house and what was happening, and how disgusted I felt, and how you know, the ambulance would come to my house, and I was just like, oh man. And and it was real hard. It was real hard. And it's like I made it harder on myself by not dealing with it in these meetings for a long time. You know, finally at one point it dawned on me in my wisdom that, you know, Noreen, better people than you have gotten loaded. You are living under a lot of stress. People were telling me that. I mean, you know, I work with a guy that was like, "What are you doing?" You know, and it's like, "Oh, it's okay." And he's just, you know, one of God's messengers out there prodding me and out there telling me the truth. And sometimes I'd be real mad, but I had to listen, you know. And I joke about, you know, how I'll tell this story maybe in a year or two. I saw the problem and quickly took care of it, you know. Yeah. No, it took a long time. And part, you know, October and November and December of last year were real tough because the disease that was active and being fed in my house was real rampant, and my disease was real rampant. And, you know, I would daydream a lot about this person dying. You know, and I'd pray to God that this person would die, because then that way I wouldn't have to do anything. See, that way I wouldn't have to take any steps or take care of myself. That, you know, come on. Give me a break. There's insurance, you know what I mean? But, true story. But God saw fit that I had to do some work on it myself. And it's like, and again, I'm having real trouble because it's like I want to talk about my part in it without throwing guilt, and, you know, and I'm not a victim. I participated in this, and it's like I prayed real hard because I want to be fair. You know, part of what had happened was this person went into a recovery home, hospital thing, and they called me the next day, and they had said, you know, "We need to talk to you," and my heart had been just, oh. I said, "Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that he was walking." And the guy says, "Yeah, well, he's almost walked three times." "And what's your stance?" I said, "If he walks, I walk." And he says, "Are you willing to say that?" And I said, "You bet." So what I did, you know, some of the things we learn from the streets can be helpful today. I had an appointment at 3:30. At 2:30, I went to my house, and I packed enough for me and my son for 2 weeks. I packed work clothes. I packed fun clothes. I packed some of his favorite toys. I was ready. And I went to that unit, and I met with this family guy, and he wanted me to hospitalize myself. You know, he's like, "You are on the edge, lady. And if you don't, you're real high candidate for relapse." And I said, "I know that, and that scares me." You know, at one point, they've got this thing floating around in professional places that talk about, like, 38 signs of relapse. And I had read through those, and I had, like, 30 of them, and I went, "Whoa, huh, gee. Maybe I'd better look at that, you know?" You're not above getting loaded, Noreen. And I went to this unit and met with this guy. And when I came out, he got hit. And they said to my spouse, "You're out of here." And I said, "I'm out of here too." And so I left and I laid low. Laid low. I was a wreck. I mean, you know, this was like New Year's Eve. I was at a function, and I'm, oh man. But you know what? The people in the program were there, man. They were with me, and they helped me walk through that. You know, it's like somebody helped me stay at their apartment, and then I had to leave because they didn't let kids there. So I went to stay with another woman in her house, and I stayed there for like 2 months. And then they ended up having problems, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, the husband of the couple shows up, and at 7, his dad arrives, and they start throwing furniture in the truck, and he says, you know, I hate to do this, Noreen, but you need to leave. And I'm like, oh, man. And, you know, this is a spiritual program, and I know that God loves me. But I'm here to tell you there were some moments in those last few months when I did keep praying desperately, you know, God, what do you want for me? But there was times when it was real dim. And it's like, you know what? Bottom line, I'd start with, please don't let me get loaded and show me what you want me to do. And then finally, he gave me the willingness to do it, you know. When I had to leave this house, here I am one more time. I'm loading stuff, everything I own, into my car. And my son, I had taken one of his lamps, his little teddy bear lamp, and I'm, you know, madly throwing stuff in the car. And here he comes out of the house carrying his teddy bear lamp. Let's go, Mom. I'm okay. Just don't forget my lamp. And, you know, and he was cool. It's like, well, where are we going to sleep tonight? And, you know, and people in the fellowship. It's like I spent a couple of nights on people's floors. I spent one night in a motel, and then I said, this is ridiculous. I'm renting myself an apartment, you know. And so for 2 months, my son and I lived in an apartment. And it was real tough, but it's better today, you know. I am in the process of a divorce today because I freaked, you know. I really freaked. There was a point there where I said, you know what, I'm going to go crazy. And I have to shut this door, you know. And part of what I have to own is not doing something about it earlier, you know, because that is an old pattern for me. Letting all of this stuff build up and then, blah, and it's over, you know. And that is one of my defects, that I do that, you know. It's like holding those resentments and holding that stuff. And I kill them. I kill relationships. You know, that's a pattern for me. It's like I let it build up so bad that it dies. And, you know, and where I am today is that I am living by myself, and it's real peaceful. And I'm also real aware that, you know, they talk about the first year being a gift. Mine was not a gift. I mean, I struggled for that, and it was tough. But this last year has been a gift because I was not doing a whole lot to work on my recovery and just keep myself growing. What I was doing a lot is shoving my feelings and treading water, and that I'm real fortunate that God kept me clean last year. Where I am today is that I am pursuing this thing, you know? It's like I want to stay clean. I want to continue to be able to come to rooms like this and be a part of this program, you know? I was real lucky that God kept me clean last year. You know, one of the things that early on my sponsor had told me was, you know, Noreen, there will come a time when there won't be a meeting available, when what you're going to have is yourself, your God, and your book. And, you know, I put myself in that time. You know, these meetings never left me. The fellowship never left me. I'm the one that isolated. You know, I'm the one that stuffed those feelings and kept myself from being involved, kept myself from talking the truth, you know. And what I've been working on real hard is sharing the truth in meetings today, because that's, you know, that's where it is. That's where my lifeline is in the meetings of Narcotics Anonymous, you know. And I'm real grateful to have made it to the other side. You know, I'm real grateful to be able to be up here. I mean, you know, this is a real honor. And I thank Narcotics Anonymous for it, you know. And I hope you all have a bang-up time, because now I'm gonna. Thank you for letting me share.